Hey folks, welcome to the Brief Encounter podcast with me, Johnny Boyle. This is episode 2, and in this episode I'm talking to Irish drum legend Graham Hopkins. Graham is currently playing with David Keenan, but he's also played with the likes of Glenn Hansard, The Frames, Dolores O'Riordan. He's released 2 albums with his own band, Haylight. He did 3 albums with Therapy. His very first band was My Little Funhouse. He was signed to Geffen Records when he was in his mid-teens, moved to LA and was hanging out with the likes of Guns N' Roses and Alice in Chains. In this episode, Graham just talks about his love of coffee. We talk about our love for 90s grunge bands. We do go full drum nerds for a little while. I have a slight nervous tick on this podcast for some reason. I keep saying, you know? I need to stop doing that. It's quite annoying. So hopefully it won't annoy you too much. I'd like to thank everyone who listened in to my last podcast, episode 1 with Dave Brown from Picture House. The amount of downloads have exceeded my expectations. So thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you like this episode. And coming up in episode 3, I will be talking to Fair City actor Jim Bartley. So thanks for tuning in, guys. Please like and subscribe on Apple iTunes. And I will see you all soon. Bye. So, where are we, Graham? Where are we?
We're flying. That's where we are.
Look at this. I've got notes. Notes. Oh, look at that now.
You've done your homework.
I've got your life story here on 2 pages. It's only 2 pages.
It's all right. 2 pages of life.
Yeah. Okay. So we're at P&S Coffee Roasters.
There's 2 brothers called Peter and Simon. They opened a place in Nace, which is a bit of a distance away. Nace, it's all but 6 miles. And then they actually opened this place in Clane. I've no reason ever to leave Clane again.
That's
my
nice.
Own, and they roast their beans, they sell their beans. Beautiful coffee. They're bringing in from all the beautiful places. Several places from beautiful places from South America, from around Africa. You know, look, beautiful map over there that obviously you listening can't hear. And I come down on Wednesdays and Thursdays when they roast as well, and I can be their guinea pig.
Oh, yeah?
Tasting beans as well.
Was that because I know you've become a coffee connoisseur. Is that because you gave up the drink?
Yeah, well, I did. I gave up the drink roughly about 10 years now. And if I do have any sort of addiction, it's most definitely the coffee,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
One of my things, as you know, is going away on tour. You know, you have that time, you get up every day, what will I do today? Yeah. And you obviously go for the coffee walk.
Yeah.
And it's a joy, you know, no matter how far away the good, eloquent coffee house is, you know, you go for that walk. And that's a bit of a release every day.
Yeah, yeah. True, nice.
And I have a few of those places marked down, so everywhere if and when I do go back to those towns, I know where to go.
It's funny because I know sometimes you go into a coffee shop and they'll start telling you in great detail where the bean is from, and you know, and I'm just sitting there going, if you don't inject that caffeine into my eyeballs in the next 5 seconds, I'm going to go mental. I don't care where it's from, just get it into me.
I'm usually the first one to ask them that question. Yeah. And the kids are usually tearing my arse going, oh, Dad, would you shut up? Would you come on, you know? I'm having the boring conversation, you know?
It's a far cry from Maxwell House instant coffee.
Yeah, totally.
That you could only get back in the 80s and 90s in Dublin.
Enjoying popping. Do you remember
popping
the
lid?
Popping the lid, yeah.
That was the best bit. Even if you didn't drink coffee, it was like popping the lid.
You could probably get about 3 pops out of it, you know? You definitely get the first. You get the second or third pop, couldn't you?
That was the best thing about that coffee. Yeah. So, I saw you.
Coffee?
I
Coffee's good, by the way. I'm having a flat white here.
I thought we were going to just elongate that coffee chat, but that's
it. We'll come back to coffee when we'll have a second coffee. I'll be wired then. I've already had one today. Very nice flat white.
So I saw you
at the Electric Picnic.
All right.
I was running by the main stage, and sure, there you were on the big screen playing with David Keenan. So you've been out with him a lot lately, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
So what's happening there?
I started playing with him about over 2 years ago. I was actually doing a little kind of charity gig. It was a great night. Done a couple of them in Spirit Store with Glenn Hansard and Joe Doyle. So it was just three of us doing. It was this young lad. You know the way you get those kind of gigs and there's somebody that nobody knows, get invited up or asked up to do a song, and this is genuine.
This was him,
and he just from Dundalk, and he got up and done a tune, and within seconds he started giving me shivers on my, you know, because you knew he was just lyrically, melodically for me doing something, you know, just grabbed you, you know. And I really enjoyed playing with him that night. And the two of us kept in touch from then on.
Sure.
Because I couldn't help but kind of keep in touch with him because I loved what he did. And he was 20 years old then. So it's not often, you know, not belittling, but like, it's not often you keep in touch with a 20-year-old singer-songwriter.
Sure.
Unless they're doing something really special that you know that will just grow and grow.
So it was just a chance meeting, really.
It really was
so
a chance meeting.
So it was nothing like, oh, check out this guy. It was just literally on the night.
Yeah, it was on the night.
That's great. So did you introduce him to people like Gavin Glass and the guys in the band, or how did that all come about?
Well, the Gavin thing, well, what happened was then, about a year later, David asked me, would I get in touch, or would I help him out, just do this video for one song that he had, a song called James Dean. And we did this video in Johnny Cronin's, the Cronin Studio.
Up in Drumlish.
Yeah, you've recorded there.
I have, it's a great spot.
It's hard to play drums there because You're trying to play, but at the same time you're looking at all of this stuff that's hanging up in the studio.
Gear.
Yeah, gear and a picture of so-and-so. Like, it could be a picture of him and Johnny Cash, Johnny Cronin, or Ronan with, you know, Elvis. Hold on, Elvis died so many years ago. No, it is. It's him and Elvis, you know. I mean, it's just a great, great studio. But we did that song there. And it was just a great band. And since then, things have just grown.
Yeah,
it's like the world is genuinely taking attention to David Keenan. And I love him. His songs are just much more than your average song.
Yeah,
it's like a real true poem. You know, it's every song just really lures you in. It's a real poetic, beautiful story. If you were to compare him to anybody, which is, I don't think, fair all the time. He is what he is.
Sure.
But I'd put him in the same place as a Leonard Cohen or a Serge Gainsbourg or something like that. But melodically, I do love what he does. It can be a lot more dangerous. And then now when he's putting down the guitar, he's liable to go anywhere when we do gigs.
I've seen a few pictures of him in the crowd, just
in the crowd
surfing.
Crowd surfing, top off.
I mean,
you know,
when would you see that at a singer-songwriter's gig? It's like something you'd see at a metal gig.
Exactly. And that's what he's doing. He likes putting down the guitar more and more, and then the front few rows are kind of the younger ladies who know every word of every song, even though the album hasn't been released.
Does he have this kind of orator kind of vibe about him, you know?
In what kind of respect?
Well, he's just, you know, he very much takes command of his audience. I can see that. You know, and
they listen to every teeny, absolute, every tiny word he's saying. Every, like, tiny word of a poem. They believe him. He's like, he's kind of ruling the roost.
Sure, sure.
To the nth degree, you know?
Yeah.
He could walk everybody off the edge of peers.
Sure,
I don't know. But that's what I just really, and he could do the same with us. We're just following him, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's none of this ever talk of, you know, the typical, stereotypical, let's shorten this song down to 3.5 minute pop song. You cannot do that with a David Keenan song. I mean, the shortest song on the album is 3.5 minutes, but that wasn't a planned event. It just happened to be like that.
Sure. And how long is the longest song? 4 hours.
No, 6 hours. So his album's out in January. We go to New York, and the amount of festivals we did during the summer were brilliant, and every one was, you know, they got pretty insane.
Yeah, I really like that photograph of him, where, I mean, he does look like the ghost of Charlie Chaplin. Oh, I mean, similarities between that particular photograph Charlie Chaplin photograph, hair.
Yeah.
He looks really like him.
He does, doesn't he?
It's mental.
And he loves that whole buzz. And it's not true longing to look like that, but he loves that whole 20s kind of, 20s, 30s kind of look.
Sure, sure.
You know, but you can't say this. He was never after it in the first place, but that kind of old look, the Peaky Blinders kind of thing, which Aidan Gillen actually kind of got in touch with him as well. The two of them have become good friends, and he was like, oh, thank you, you know?
Yeah.
That's just his vibe. You know?
So are you looking at 2020 then as like, if that's going to be a busy year for him once that record comes out?
Big time, you know? He recently signed with Ruby Works, who, you know, is, of course, Hozier's label, Rodrigo and Gabriella. So they're giving us absolutely everything, you know. So that hasn't quite, you know, started yet. It hasn't been put into gear yet. And when it does, when it is put into gear, it's just, whoa, wait for me!
Yeah. Well, it's always nice when you can just get on the back of something that's on an upward kind of trajectory, you know what I mean? Because I do think he can tap into that, I suppose, I mean, Glenn Hanser, Damien Rice kind of audience as well in America, you know?
As well, he can do that. But I suppose because he's Irish, you know, which is always a helping thing. But as well as that, he has the Irish accent, of course. But I think as well as that, he's so much more than that because of his danger.
Sure,
his
sure.
dangerous element.
Sure. Well, I think in recent years there has been that kind of influx of the Irish singer-songwriter, but that's kind of starting to change now with bands like the Fontaines, DC.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know,
you
know, I mean, I saw them last year at Forbidden Fruit. I've seen them. They've all gone to BIM, so,
yeah,
you know, I know. A few of them, but I mean, they remind me of the Strokes or the Sex Pistols or, you know, but I was looking at them thinking, if I was an 18-year-old girl now, I'd be digging the shit out of these guys.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and there's other bands like the Murder Capital.
Yeah.
They just released a record. They would be slightly different, but again, pretty intense band. And, you know, their debut album in at number 2 in Ireland, which is a great start for them.
It is great.
You know?
So it's that kind of post-punk there. It's kind of the next little thing for like Irish bands. It's great. The Fall kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
With the guys and with the Fontaines guys, you can't be Jesus. And like you and me, you know, with the BIM thing, you can't but be proud of those guys.
Oh, it's,
you know,
great. It's great
watching Tom Call, especially us being drummers, just going, oh, we're so proud of you, dude.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It is.
I wonder who's going to be, where's it go from here? You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so many acts that are, you know, I mean, even like, there's everything from punk bands to, as you say, post-punk, indie bands. There's R&B artists, there's pop artists, there's, you know, it's so diverse, a lot of these kids that are coming out of college, you know? And as you say, there is an enormous sense of pride taken from all of us, because we've tried to, as
I'd say, like the
degree.
Amount like that amount of Irish bands that are really like kicking in with a vengeance, it's by no means going to stop over the next couple of years.
Yeah,
and I think there was a big lull in that kind of way for many a year. It's definitely, it's kicking at the moment.
Well, I mean, when you look at, I suppose, your Glens and your Damien's and, you know, Damien Rice, Damien Dempsey, all of those guys are mid-40s, heading for 50, so the kind of cycle is coming around again.
Do you mean
the next
50s heading for their 60s?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of them, you know, have been knocking around for, I mean, Jesus, Graham, we're knocking around 30 years now. 30 years. Yeah. That's funny because I was doing some research. I was just reading up on your wiki page and stuff, and I didn't realise you played on 3 Therapy albums, because when I met you first, I think you'd kind of just gotten the gig around then, you know? And
Was I not... Because I was thinking about this earlier on this morning, and I totally remember our first evening out, which...
Did we go to Eddie Rockets?
We did indeed, yeah, yes.
There's a plug, Eddie Rockets.
Yes. Is there a nickname for Eddie Rockets? Come on.
I don't know. It's been a while since I've been in it. But I remember meeting you.
You were after doing a... No, you weren't. No, you weren't. Aidan Pierce was gigging after doing one of those gigs at a band called The Picture House.
He played with Picture House in the Bag It
In.
The Bag It In.
And you were on a hiatus from The Picture House, although you'd been in them.
I've been in and out of them several times.
Yes.
You know?
You sure
have.
A bit
of the old in and out with Picture House.
You have.
Well, so, look, I did a podcast with Dave last week.
And you talked about the in and outs.
We talked about all of that.
Did you sort out any issues that you had?
Well, you know, hindsight's a great thing. But yeah, we addressed certain things that happened over the years. It was an interesting, very honest chat as well.
That's good,
you know?
Isn't it?
But I remember that night. I don't particularly remember the Picture House gig, but I remember you, me, and our good friend Tom Pollard, who him and Shaky ran the drum department of Music Maker all through the 90s. So they were our go-to guys for drum stuff. And they were our buddies.
Jesus.
Still are. But we went to Eddie Rockets, and I remember being quite envious of you, because at the time, Therapy were just at the peak of a
tune. Sure, I wasn't.
You were only 19 or
was
something.
Was I not still in my little funhouse then?
You could have been. I mean, it was 96. 96 you joined Therapy?
Yeah.
So,
and I have the feeling that when we met then,
you could have been still in my...
It could have been 94.
Yeah. I was definitely a bit younger. I was probably about 19 years old. So you're talking around 92, 93, I'd say, when I met.
Okay, so I was still in my little funhouse.
Okay. So now, the My Little Funhouse story is unbelievable, because I was actually listening to Duff McKagan. Is it Kagan or Kagan? Duff McKagan.
Let's say McKagan.
Duff McKagan. Being interviewed by Mark Maron, actually. And it was an amazing podcast. He is such a clever guy, you know what I mean? Just very engaging. You know, he's an old punk at heart, you know. But that interview was just one of my favourite interviews I heard this year. You know what I mean? I have a lot of respect for him.
And was that just last weekend?
He did a podcast about a month ago. On, you know, check it out if you hear it. But, you know, you're talking about Joe Doyle from The Frames. He was telling me, like, you guys were signed to Geffen, and did you have to leave school to go out to LA? Is this...
Yeah, it's great actually doing it here and now where we are in Glen, because both myself and Joe went to school up on this road here where we are now, and I got the call on the Thursday, the Friday, to ask if I'd like go over to Amsterdam, to the Paradiso,
right,
to kind of join / a drum tech for this band, My Little Funhouse.
Yeah.
Because the drummer, they wanted to kind of, I don't know, kind of, the drummer didn't know it, a guy called Derek Maher. He didn't know it, but they wanted to give him the kind of P45 because he was just causing a lot of trouble, you know. And so they wanted to bring me over and kind of get to know me and kind of hear me play during sound checks and stuff And a good friend of mine, Tom Pollard, we've talked about Tom Pollard a few times. A friend of mine, Tom Skerritt, who
Sound engineer.
Yeah, sound engineer.
He was doing sound in the picnic for me last week.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh,
he saved my ass because none of my stuff was working. So.
Right, oh, God. Tom's a great guy. He used to work at Mickham Sound in Dublin from around the age of 14, 15, 16. Yeah. That's through my dad. And if we started talking about my dad, I think we'd be here forever. Is there a clock off time on how long this podcast could be?
We usually do around an hour 15. We're 20 minutes in and we've so much to talk about.
Oh, brilliant.
So you're 15, 16?
I'm 17.
You're 17, right? 17. And you're teching for the band.
So then, my parents, I got the call to go over if I do that. So I flew over on the Friday, left school. My parents, after much as you know,
so as in left school, left. I'm out of here. So
manager from Kilkenny came up, met my parents, said, "Come on, like, will I?" I was kind of trying to convince my parents to let me do it, and they knew it was all I cared about. It was all I wanted to do. No interest in school, you know. Even though I had the leaving cert in about 2 months from that.
So did you bail? You bailed. You bailed on the leaving cert?
Yeah, bailed on the leaving cert. And then they heard me play during sound checks and stuff like that. So they knew once we got back from a little stint with the band Thunder opening for them. Do you remember them?
Yeah, I do indeed.
I got back a few weeks later and they straight away then that the drummer was kind of let go and I was in then.
Yeah.
And then my little funness continued on for the next 3 years. The bass player then, he did leave the band, and straight away I said, my best mate, Joe Doyle, and Joe lives about a few miles up this road up here, and I said, my best mate, Joe, he's the man for the job. Yeah. They'd never even met Joe.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, James.
Thank you.
Where's that from?
Ethiopian. We're trying some new coffee here. Ethiopian blend.
Oh, thank you.
So.
Yes. Very nice. Ethiopian coffee.
I'm going to be wired on caffeine.
That's the whole thing.
So tell me.
So then Joe joined the band.
So did Joe leave school?
Joe left school. He was just after doing his intercert.
Oh, my God.
So he arrived over, and the boys had never met him, but just took my opinion. Remember waiting at the in the arrivals in LAX.
Yeah.
And Joe's slightly smaller, I think you'd agree.
Ah, yeah.
And they were kind of waiting for me. I knew what to expect. And the lads were like, oh, what are we doing? Because you could see, like, this little head just above the kind of, the barrier pushing this kind of,
the trolley.
The trolley with a bass guitar and a bag. But then the next day in rehearsals, they heard him play and they were just like, God, this guy's a beast.
Yeah.
You know, and at that time I remember me and Joe being into Alice in Chains and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And so we were rocking the house, and then the next couple of years having my best mate in living in LA with me were just absolutely sensational, you know. Living between LA and LA and Kilkenny, okay. and Eddie Rockets.
Because I mean, I suppose early 90s, mid-90s, there was a huge influx of record labels into Ireland. When Joshua Tree became a huge record, and the Commitments came out, everybody was interested in Irish bands. They thought there was kind of some fairy dust here or Leprechaun Gold to be made.
Oh, yeah, completely.
So loads of, every band got signed, except Lear.
that's very true.
Which is a documentary about.
A great documentary.
Everybody got signed except them.
Oh, God.
Which was hilarious. But, So off the back of that, so the band was already signed to Geffen at this point when you joined. So there was money there.
There was ridiculous amounts of money there. Like, we went on to, in LA, like, living in LA, recorded two albums for unbelievable amounts of money. One made by Bill Price, the other made by a guy called... why can't I remember now? And I'm under pressure
talking
to you.
The second album, I know. But it's so long ago.
The second album, but the both of them were the second album. I should remember the second album because we're the other name because we're still good mates. It's just one of those things. Neither of them were released, and just stupid amounts of money spent on them. Bill Price, who's obviously a big name producer, has done The Clash, he's done the Guns N' Roses, and then basically what happened, and this is the truth, there was a thing put into all new bands that were signing to Geffen called the Funhouse Clause.
Right.
Which was a thing that if a new band was being signed to Geffen, they weren't going to be signed to that amount of money that my little Funhouse initially got signed to, because it was like up to a ridiculous amount of 5 million that, oh my God, we're not going to sign a band for that.
Yeah.
Get the band to record the two albums, living in LA, getting paid this and that, you know. And
at this point, the guys from Guns N' Roses kind of took you under their wing,
we
didn't they?
Yeah, like, even like a tax write-off, I think, for Guns N' Roses, you know.
Sure, that's all right.
Matt Sorum, the drummer, did a kind of a... he did demos with us as well. He was producing some stuff for us.
Wow.
Like, I wanted to see Duff McKagan at the picnic last weekend, but he was playing another day. I didn't hang around. All of those guys were great to us. They all kind of played guest appearances on stuff that we recorded, which didn't see the light of day. For being 17, 18, it was just kind of surreal. It was just something that happened. It's too long ago now for me to even look back on, you know?
Do you find when you look... I'd said this to someone else. Sometimes when you look back on that stuff, it's like you're peeking into someone else's life to some degree. It's like, did that actually happen?
Because
it's so long ago, you know.
So long ago. Yeah. I remember being... Again, me and Joe, remember we went to see Alice in Chains in the SFX, and the gig was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Absolutely unbelievable. We were leaping around up near the front. I remember the Wild Hearts opened them for them. And we went to see Alice in Chains because one of our favourite bands at the time, you know. It was on touring their big album. We were in the cusp of the grunge scene
at the moment.
And that album, Dirt. And it was unbelievable. And a couple of months later, I was in LA and we were recording with the guy who just had produced their Unplugged album.
Okay.
And all of the guys from Alice in Chains came to visit us in the studio. So I'm sitting there going, what the is going on in my life right now? I'm just hanging out with the guys from Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
It was beyond surreal. Beyond surreal. So, although, you know, naturally I thought I was the biggest rock star in the world coming home to this village of Clane, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that couldn't be helped. I was 17.
Of course.
Jesus. 18. Yeah. I thought I was cooler than cool.
Yeah, you know?
What was I meant to do? Going, Jill, how are you, lads?
But was there a sense of coming back then to Dublin with your tail between your legs to some degree after a kind of... What was the turning point for it just kind of imploding? As it says on the wiki page, the band imploded. It's cliche kind of thing to say about a band. Yeah. Come on, did you just fucking kill each other?
Well, I had to leave because of one particular person in the band. I wanted to get out there musically as well. Mentioning Joe quite often, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
It was kind of like this kind of cock rock kind of thing.
Sure.
And so I joined the band in the first place because you know, you don't often get the chance to join a signed band when you're 17 and go and live in Los Angeles.
Sure.
Of course.
Living the dream.
Of course.
You know?
They had more in common with the likes of Guns N' Roses, but I had more in common with the whole grunge scene.
Sure.
Whereas, like, I had more in common drumming-wise with the likes of Jeff Beccaro and Steve Gadd, and all I was doing was reading Rhythm magazine you know, I was just obsessed with my bedroom covered in drum posters. And I was on tour with them listening to the likes of still listening to 1142 and stuff.
Sure
Which was the polar opposite, you know.
But you were one of those, from what I can gather, like, you really immersed yourself in the whole drummer culture, as in I just gave you back your box of Modern Drummer magazines, which has been in my house for about 4 years, and there's about 200 Modern Drummer magazines.
You could see.
But, you know, you really got into that. You know, you're very much, anytime I hear you speak about drummers, like, you're very well versed in kind of the history of it and the who's who and all of that kind of stuff. Like, you've kind of done your homework over the years. But I think because you're so passionate about it, you know.
Yeah, it's been my life.
So...
But you have been as well, haven't
you? Yeah, but
you?
I mean, I couldn't afford magazines, you know, or drum lessons when
but
I was
the same
a teenager.
The same way as you talk about Will Calhoun. I was totally into him, but it wasn't always because of the metal heavy side of Living Colour, first and foremost. It was because of my passion about Will Calhoun and his playing, and then what he did on the Buddy Rich Memorial concert, and then Time's Up, the album, and you know, and that was the story with so many bands.
Yeah. I mean,
do you agree?
Well, the 90s, I suppose the 90s, I'd consider our time, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Like, up to that point, you know, I was listening to Pink Floyd and the Beatles and kind of all my dad's vinyl, you know, and then. I know, look, you know, Bill Burr was talking about this. He was talking about, Smells Like Teen Spirit came out and it changed everything. Well, I saw that video at 2 in the morning on like Headbangers Ball or something like that on MTV or, you know, or an alternative show. And I mean, it just blew my mind, you know. And that's when, you know, this is before the internet as well. So then people were talking about Alice in Chains and the Chili Peppers. And I was into the Chili Peppers before that because they had Mother's Milk and the Uplift Mofo Party Plan.
Yeah, they did,
So, you know, I was into them from about 88.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then you had, I remember hearing Gish for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which blew my mind. You know, and then Fishbone. I went to London to see Fishbone when I was like 19 with a bunch of, with AO and, you know, Keith and a load of lads. And, and Living Colour, obviously, who I've seen live 3 times now.
Yeah.
You know, but I saw Will Calhoun at a Zildjian day with Tony Williams.
Oh, in Scotland.
It was in Scotland, yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
It was Vinnie Caliuta, Will Calhoun, Keith LeBlanc, and Tony Williams. So
that's fantastic, Tony Williams.
So when I went to see Living Colour, it's funny now because when you go and see bands, right, you wouldn't have got near Living Colour 20 years ago.
Yeah.
They played in Glasgow. Minute the gig's over, the boys are down the merch stand.
Yeah.
You know, selling the t-shirts, selling it, because that's what bands have to do now if they want to make a book. But I got chatting to him and I was saying, you know, because, you know, sometimes someone might come up to you and go, do you remember that time you played? And you're like, no.
No.
I've done a billion gigs. I honestly don't. But sometimes you say, yeah, I remember that gig, out of politeness. But I was saying to him, do you remember doing that drum clinic? You know what I mean? He was like, totally remember. Because he got to play with Tony Williams, who would have been one of his idols.
Oh,
so, you know. But but going back to all those drummers, like, I mean, Stephen Perkins, Tim Herb Alexander. I mean, it was a real exciting time.
Yeah.
I'll always, Chad Smith, who I know is a pal of yours, who you've had play in Dublin many times, you know, that Blood Sugar Sex Magic record, I mean, that I just learned that whole record.
Jesus.
And that's, and you know, and playing
boom,
along
chugga, to chugga,
that.
Boom, chugga, chugga, boom. The first song on that just comes to me.
Power of the Equality. Power and the Equality.
Yes.
That's just a great record.
Like that whole period, and like you mentioned a second ago, that whole period was something that, when it kicked in, was the first thing that took me over. Before that, I think I was in school, just up there. I was definitely in nerd status.
Yeah.
Because I'd go into school, I didn't have a pal or any friends that were listening to the same shit as me.
I would have been the same in school, yeah.
Yeah.
Even when I was gigging at 14, I'd be saying, I was gigging. They wouldn't believe me.
Yeah.
No, you weren't.
Yeah.
What? You're full of shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's where we were very lucky to have, like my dad being the jazz drummer, which if I go into that again, I talk about my father, I was doing an interview only last week, and it was like, I love him, Jesus, my best friend, but I've, of course, my darling wife, if she heard me saying that, she'd kill me. But like,
sorry. It's your dad.
Yes, my dad, but he is my best friend, very same as yourself. And for good reason. It's like, I wouldn't be hitting the drums without him. I wouldn't have become the drum nerd I am without him. up till that year when that scene kicked in, it would just be drums. This, my bedroom, like I said, was just drummers all ripped out of those, like, all these drum magazines, I remember going on a trip to London with him, okay? He was doing a few gigs, and the two of us hung around after the gigs, just went to every drum shop in London.
Yeah.
And it was something great for me. I didn't come back with any drum gear on that. Maybe a China cymbal that my beautiful, kind uncle bought for me.
Right.
He knew nothing about drums,
yeah.
But he did buy me a Zildjian China, which was amazing. But the amazing thing that I got was, it was like a Perlad, but it was like a framed Dennis Chambers ad, you know, it was like
a framed one.
It was like, yeah, it was huge, so I could put it up in my bedroom.
Yeah, you know.
That was like, yeah, it took over my bedroom. So then I had like another one, which was, and I remember all these things, it was like a huge kind of paste, Jeff Beccaro poster.
Right.
And I remember crying the day Jeff Beccaro died, you know. But anybody else in this little village where we are now would go, Who the hell is Jeff Beccaro?
Yeah, yeah.
Who the hell is Dennis Chambers?
Yeah.
Like,
and even if you told them who they were, they wouldn't give a shit.
Like, you know, they wouldn't. And then today, if they heard all these songs by this guy, Jim Keltner or whatever, you know. But like, and nowadays they'd kind of know more about those people because of this kind of, I don't know what it is. Probably our generation. They're more akin to those classic songs because of it. But that was who we are, you know?
Yeah, but I think at that stage for me, 16, 17, I was starting to just gravitate more towards musicians.
Yes.
You know, we there started to become a scene and we all started to get to know each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of friendships. And, you know, for some reason, why are drummers great mates? Why do so many drummers hang out with drummers?
Brilliant.
What is it? Do we have a disease or something like that? I don't know what it is. You know? I just found as well, just becoming a little bit more distant than from the people I went to school with and grew up with and stuff like that. I was starting to play more. I was starting to just be around musicians more, and that kind of, kind of grew apart from all those people, you know.
Yeah.
You do feel somewhat misunderstood.
Yeah.
And leaving school at 16, I left after my intercert. Mm. And you know, it's that kind of thing.
And
what are you
can
doing?
Can I ask, why did you leave?
Because the school I went to, I had a year master who just bullied me for a year because I was gigging and I wouldn't play rugby for the school. So he just took it upon himself to kind of verbally dress me down on several occasions in front of everyone, which is kind of degrading.
Have we talked about that before?
We might have talked about it before, but you know, I actually spoke to the principal of the school recently, and the point
a different principal.
The point I tried to make is that when you're 15 years old and you're defenceless, kind of verbally from a grown man, you know, somebody might be doing something to you that they think is insignificant, but to you it's quite significant.
Yeah.
And actually, the principal I spoke to, she was super, and she wasn't defensive at all, and it actually kind of gave me she invited me down to the school, say, look, have a coffee, I'll show you around, I'll show you how things have changed. And even just that offer and how nice she was, that kind of gave me a bit of closure on that, you know. So I kind of walked, because I know, I was going to ask you, when you came back from America then with my little, was there a part of you going, oh, will I go back to school? Or I was just out of there. I didn't look back, you know.
I didn't look back, but the only thing I had was the leaving cert, and I felt very cocky, to be honest, because I had it coming up about 2 months after I came back from my first initial Johns, and I went in. I had two honour subjects, and one of them was English, and I went into the first English exam that morning and did it, and then I came home. I didn't go in and do the second one. Came home at lunchtime and I said, no, I won't bother going in and do the second one. And that was it. And my parents were going, how'd you do? And they said, I won't bother going in and do the second one. I got my certificate, whatever, a few months later, and said, failed failed the leaving, you know.
Yeah.
With just one English thing, I got an F or something in it. So that was it. I just left. Wow. Even framed it in my parents' house for the laugh, you know.
Funnily enough, most of the people, my friends that I grew up with, that did not excel academically in any way. If anything, it was a disaster for them. They've all done well in life. You know, they have a good work ethic. You know, they've all, you know, I mean, when I did my intercert on the first day, I went in and did two exams, and then I went out to Dublin Airport and I flew to Cork to play a gig.
There you go.
You know,
there
and you go. Drove home that night, got home at 5 a.m, got up. I did all my exams, except for science. Yeah, I remember you were required to sit there for a half an hour, and then you could leave. So I just sat there for a half an hour, and then just split.
Yeah.
I failed. I had no interest in science. I'm a drummer, for God's sakes. Logic doesn't come into it.
Talking about it with, you know, my own, our eldest daughter yesterday, she's 14. And, like, obviously, I love my wife so much. And it was funny having, like, two different opinions. My own wife, like, our eldest daughter's only in second year, but our daughter was just asking us. And I was saying, you know, after leaving cert, if you want to go to college, that's cool. But I'd say, you know, take some time off.
Yeah.
Just travel the world. The world is so small.
Yeah.
Go and see the place and experience the world. And then come back. If you want, come back and then choose if you'd like to go do the leaving cert. And if you don't want to, fine. But then if you want to do the leaving cert and if you want to go to university or whatever, you know, live life how you want, you know.
That's it. Very philosophical. That's very... But you're right, Joy. We've both got two kids and, you know, I don't think... I think the way we kind of want them to live their lives is to embrace life a little bit more and not have to get bogged down in the kind of... This kind of competitive parenting where it's like, you know, you've got to be the best and strive for the best and, you know, be a doctor or be a brain surgeon or...
Yeah.
Not everybody has to strive for that, you know what I mean? It's okay to be mediocre.
It is.
Alright, so let me ask you.
Ask me away.
So you came back from America, right? So my little fun house.
We're still at the fun house.
Was there an element of kind of you know, where you were just down, or was there a kind of hiatus where you were like, oh, what's the next gig now? I've left school, I've you know, I've gone for this and now it hasn't worked out, so what do I do next? So,
well, with my little fun house, it's really started to bore me, both musically and personally. Then the band came back out, or the band came back home to Kilkenny, where the band was based. It was one of those things, like the previous album that was recorded, when's it going to be released, what's the matter? And there was one particular individual in the band that me and him didn't get on. That's that guy. You're not that guy. And so I decided I wanted to get out somewhere. And then I got word that Therapy, who obviously you couldn't avoid but knowing, needed a drummer, and was very fortunate that some of my best mates, genuinely best mates, were in the band Curb Dog. And Curb Dog, who had a great time with, were in LA the same time as My Little Funhouse, recording their album. So we spent a few months in LA with them. You can imagine that the age we were at, we were all around 19, 20. For a few months recording their amazing On the Turn album, and we were recording My Little Funhouse album that has never been released.
So was this the album, Kurt? Because I remember the lads saying that this was, they knew they were getting dropped, so they just went, let's go spend a shitload of money on a record. Was that the record or was it the one after?
On the Turn.
Yeah,
for My Little Funhouse.
For Curb Dog.
Curb Dog. Oh, they never knew they were going to get released. Or they never knew it wasn't going to get released, because it certainly did get released.
Yeah.
I still think, I know we're changing the subject, but that Curb Dog album, I can genuinely, and I do always say, along with a few a Thin Lizzy albums, like I'd say Live and Dangerous, or I'd say it's up there as one of the best, without shadow of a doubt, Irish albums.
The
Turn album, On the Turn is just holy shit, it's mesmerising. It's a classic Irish album, it's a classic album, full stop.
Well, you've got bands like Biffy Clyro citing them as an influence. They really do. They're always raving
really
about the band.
Yeah, really do. And I love them. I love Cormac Battle. The songs that he writes, the choruses that he writes. It's a big thing to say, but I really do think he's an instrumental, melodic and lyrical genius.
Yeah, yeah.
And he genuinely really, really is. That album is fantastic. And they were there recording that album the same time as My Little Funhouse were there, living in the same apartment block. So when we all came back, they live in Kilkenny, My Little Funhouse live in Kilkenny. I knew I wanted to leave My Little Funhouse. They had done a few tours with Therapy. They put in the good word to the Therapy guys that I was into doing the gig. They got me a Therapy audition.
Okay.
I went in and played drums with Therapy for a day, and I was really fortunate. The guy straight away said, would I like to join the band?
So there was no messing, there was no messing. It's between you and another guy, or none of that?
No messing.
So Fife Ewan, he was the original drummer, and he kind of left at the height of it as well. Trouble Gum was a big record, so you were coming in kind of at the end of the Trouble Gum tour.
While they were in the middle of touring, just the album after that.
Oh, the album after.
Called Infernal Love.
Infernal Love, that's right.
But they were still in the middle of touring it.
Okay.
They hadn't done all the rest
of
the
touring. So he was done. He was just done with it.
Their last gig was in The Point in Dublin. His last gig was in The Point. But they still had a lot of other touring to do, like the States and other European touring stuff.
Okay.
So they asked me to do it. And however I felt, being green, being totally green, when I was asked to join Therapy, that was like beyond the beyonds of winning the most surreal lotto you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
This was joining this hugely popular big band that you'd see on TV, that you'd know all their songs without choice. They were playing arenas, they were headlining every conceivable festival. You couldn't like their tunes. From it be popular punters that loved music to hardcore kind of post-punk and punk kind of fans who liked their kind of real kind of, you know, hardcore indie stuff. They were never in the metal zone, but they'd be put in it by people like Kerrang! Magazine or
Metal Hammer and all that.
But
and a great drum gig to get.
Man, such
you know
a,
what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a energy, and you know, I was listening to Semi-Detached actually.
Oh right, okay.
I was listening to it the other day.
Because
what I didn't realise was that you did three albums. I thought you only did two. Mm. So Semi-Detached was the first one, and again, it's that high energy, you know. I suppose you can kind of see drummers like Travis Barker, and it was before all of that, but it kind of led into all of that kind of post-punk, more kind of polished kind of Americans, you know, whereas Therapy are a bit more edgy, lyrically and musically, you know, a lot more edgy.
The thing I really love about Andy Cairns is he definitely comes from the whole genuine, well, same as the guys in Green Day do come from. If you want to make any comparison, they do come from a very genuine place.
Yeah,
they just happen to get very popular, and as soon as a band gets very popular, you kind of not write them off, but you put them in an overly popular place, you know.
Yeah.
But they come from a real hardcore punk place. Andy Cairns is really unbelievably poetic musically. Even he's very intellectual musically. He comes from such diverse places. He's very I'm just thinking about this. He's very eclectic musically.
Sure.
He'd think about something, be it Neu or Kahn, in the German kind of way, you know, as far as things being very straight. And then he'd want the next thing to be very kind of swing. Although things would be very clean, but then the next minute he wanted it to be absolutely filthy, dirty.
Yeah.
And then for the next 8 bars, let's make it absolutely clean and then kick in with a vengeance. So everything had a plot and a plan.
Sure.
It was never simple.
Yeah.
But then the next song, let's make it simple and let's make it a 3.5 minute punk song.
Sure.
So that's why it really did.
Yeah.
Enjoy playing with them, you know.
Well, I mean, to do three albums in 4 years?
I was with the band for six years.
Okay, so an album every 2 years with touring. I mean, I'd say it was pretty intense.
It was very intense. I mean, if I was with the band now, I think for me it was at the ideal age, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was at the ideal age. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. When I joined them first, it was like, yeah, come on, let's go. I remember there's a Girls Against Boys. Remember, that was our first thing. And I was like, oh, shit. I thought I was joining this mammoth band. And our first tour was going out to the States in an Econoline. You know what Econoline? I'm sure you've totally done it with the frames and stuff. It's like a transit van around the States.
Okay.
And I was like, ah, come on. I've just lived in one for the last 3 years with my little
fans. No tour bus. Like,
and that's because they wanted to do it.
That was their kind of punk ethos, wasn't it?
Yeah,
just not selling out yet.
They wanted to come to America, and they wanted to do that because for the last few years they've been living the high life around Europe. And in a tour bus, or two tour buses doing production tours. It's like, ah, oh, lads, can we not live the high life?
Yeah, yeah.
But they, no. So I was like, ah, oh, balls. I said, but we did that for a couple of months around, but it was cool. It was still a couple of them with a crew and stuff. I still loved it, still really great fun. And then we came back, and this was the really scary bit, to be honest. I remember a first festival with the band was Pink Pop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Pink Pop Festival, which is in Holland?
Is it Belgium? I think it's Belgium.
Yeah, because I remember you seeing... Yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? We'll talk about that in a minute, okay? So I remember doing that, and what really freaked me out about that, I was really excited to do it, and we flew in to do that, and everything was there, everything was set up. I'm even getting a bit anxious about it now, to be honest. And I remember that was what bands were on before us. The bands like on before us were like Sepultura, Alanis Morissette, and then Rage Against the Machine were on before us.
Shit.
And I remember going out and seeing Rage Against the Machine, and I had no choice but to actually puke.
Yeah. How do you follow that?
And I was going, man, all I could do was see myself in my bedroom or in my friend Smitty's bedroom and listening to this, and all of a sudden here I am in Belgium or Holland watching this in front of 100,000 people, and here I am, and that's all I could think about. And now we have to go out and follow this, and it was like I don't know how to say all my dreams came true, but it was just like, I don't even know how to say, like, I've made it. I don't know what it is, but this is it. You know,
well, you're on that stage with some of your heroes. Like, you know, I mean, that Rage Against the Machine, that first album, you know, that was a big record for all of us back then. You know, I saw them in the Tivoli with about 400 or 500
people.
Was
that with
people.
The mirror?
It was the one where the drummer had his back to the stage.
Yes.
Brad Wilk, and he had the,
yes,
the mirrors up. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I was just completely bruised everywhere,
yeah,
from
I
the
think
barriers.
I was away when I was there. Yeah.
That was just one of the best gigs I've ever been to in my entire life. It was just outrageous because, you know, really powerful. But I can only imagine watching them side stage thinking, I have to go on next.
Yeah, go on now.
Same thing happened to me at Oxygen in 2005 or 2006 with the Frames. Snoop Dogg went on, then Queens of the Stone Age went on, and we went on after Queens of the Stone Age, and then Green Day went on after us.
So, I remember that.
Stage, 60,000-70,000 people, I don't know. And it was good. I really enjoyed it, you know. But when you're standing at the side of the stage listening to Queens, and they're on that Songs for the Dead tour as well, so that's, Songs for the Deaf, sorry. Yeah. But, I remember just thinking, it's just a privilege to be sharing a stage with these people, you know, because you're such a fan of what they do, you know. You were at the height of it then, playing those kind of festivals.
Therapy were at their height. They were totally, they were therapy, you know. The gigs before and that, you know, they just, the week, year before, they were with Metallica at Donington. Yeah. So I joined the band while they were, you know.
Did Fifeyoun ever come to a gig? Did you ever meet him?
No, I've still to this day never met him.
Isn't that mad?
I've never met him, which is strange, very, very strange. And I really would. I'm sure the two of us would get on fine, you know. I've talked about him more times, not recently, but I've talked about him numerous times. And all's cool with the guys.
Yeah.
They just knew that for no reason. I just wanted to, but not for no reason. That doesn't make any sense. Just for reasons of getting on with my life and musically, after having some absolutely amazing, more similar to what I just said at Pink Pop, I just lived out so many amazing moments.
Yeah.
Recorded great albums. The last one. The last one was something that I wasn't so particularly proud of or happy with. Everything else, just fantastic. Amazing tours, traveling the world again. I didn't want to hang out with Therapy. I had
you'd had
a really proud time. What was on my mind was just, hey, I want to record my own album.
Yeah.
I'd be on tour. We'd be on tour buses, and it was kind of surreal. The lads would be on the back of the bus. They'd be listening to, whether it be, Iggy Pop. You know, they'd be listening to Stiff Little Fingers. All these kind of different punk bands. I'd be in my bunk listening to Scott Walker, Nick Drake.
Yeah.
You know, the list goes on, the Cardigans, or, really mellow stuff.
Sure.
And they'd be totally...
just full on all the time.
And I'd be the youngest little baby. Of course, I'd wait till I got home and I'd take out all my madness in a place called Whelan's on Wexford Street.
Oh, yeah.
But on tour, I'd be concentrating on my gig, you know? But then when I came to... when I... got home, I just wanted to look into my own solo stuff, sure. You know, and record my own songs. And then the thing that really brought that to a head then was when Mick Christopher sorely kind of left us. And then that really kind of really put the cap on it, let's say, because I knew that, okay, life's kind of... you only get one chance.
So Mick passed away. He died in, is it 2001?
Yes.
He was on tour with the Waterboys, I believe. He fell down a flight of stairs, unfortunately.
And it was kind of harsh, really, because I wasn't far from him when the incident happened.
It was in Groningen, wasn't it?
It was indeed. So I was able to visit him in hospital. And then I'd get trains back to the gig.
Sure.
And then I missed sound checks. And the Therapy guys were very supportive in that manner because they knew we were friends. So then I'd miss sound checks. And even when we went back to England, I'd still do the same.
Yeah.
And then even when Mick went home to Ireland, I'd be on the phone to Binzer. And Binzer would be... giving me the latest or whatever. And then when Mick went home, I'd fly home just, you know, you wanted to be with your mates.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So I'd fly home for the removal and then fly back. I remember flying back to Scotland for the gig, and then I remember I was in London when Mick actually passed, and then flying back the next day, and then blah 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 blah, that all happened. The last night, the day of Mick's actual funeral, was my last gig in I knew it was going to be my last gig with Therapy in the Ambassador, but I hadn't told the guys. I didn't want it to be that sour, but I bet you they had that feeling.
They knew it was coming.
Yeah.
Was there a bit of a bad vibe for a while? Was there just...
But there wasn't really a bad... We were still getting on. We were mature adults, you know. The gigs were still fantastic. But they knew I wasn't feeling 100% because I'd lost a friend.
Okay.
And Mick and me were great. I mean, myself and Mick weren't best friends. But it was that kind of... just that, the whole vibe at the time,
well,
you know.
You were good friends with all Glenn and the Frames and all of that kind of crew.
Yeah.
You know, because I went to visit where it happened with the guys in the Frames, and I didn't know Mick. I knew him from around to see and stuff like that, but I didn't know him. I wasn't part of that scene at this point. But I remember it being a real emotional moment for the lads, like, you know what I mean? It was about a year after that happened, and, you know, I was quite upset to see them. As upset, but do you know what I mean? So upset about it, you know. Yeah, it was, and then part of me was going, "Why am I here? Why I probably shouldn't be down here."
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And then, but look, you know,
it's nice to be with them. You know, showing your support.
Well, there's always, I think, death is something that makes you. If a close friend dies, it makes you kind of reevaluate your own life as well, to some degree.
Well, that's exactly what it did to me. You know, well, I knew I wanted to get out of Therapy because I wasn't overly happy in many ways, you know, like I was saying about the listening to different music, going to bed every night, and wasn't feeling that anymore, and I had demoed some of my own stuff, and that really capped it off when, unfortunately, the incident happened to Mick, not knowing that he was going to pass, and then when he did, and I knew the last gig was coming up, I took it upon myself. I remember Jill, excuse me, my darling wife was in Australia, and I just said, I have to do it.
Yeah.
So I left. I told them a couple of days later, which is actually my birthday, a few days later after the last gig, because we all live in different countries or in different cities. I rang all the boys and told them, and then booked a ticket. Gillian was in Australia on just a little venture with her best friend. I booked a flight and I just flew straight out to hang out with her for a few weeks. And then it was like, go, get out. And I was with her in the for New Year's and stuff, out there for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
Okay.
Hanging out, you know, in the sun, having a laugh.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm not doing anything, you know, I'm not doing anything. I just want to live life.
But the intensity of being in a band at that level as well, and the intensity of the gigs, you know what I mean? It's that to step away from that and just take a deep breath and actually live a bit of like normal life, have a bit of normality. You kind of need that.
Yeah.
Because you can't keep up that intensity
Well,
for
that's
too
exactly
long.
What
crash and burn.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. And I wasn't enjoying getting up and hitting the shit out of the drums every night when I wasn't into the songs. They had no... Although there were great songs for people that were into it, lyrically they were doing nothing for me, you know? So I went home... first of all, I went home and Gemma Hayes then rang me and she said, would you like to play with me? Just like that. And so I had no time even to... No,
so you
time.
Just walk out of that gig into another gig
straight away.
So that was the Night on My Side record. Was
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah, it was.
So 2000 and what? That's 2002.
Yes.
Because we met on that tour.
Yes, we did.
We did a
Marianne
gig.
Faithful. Yeah, where were we?
It might have been the Ancien Belgique in Brussels. Was it there?
Do you know where it was?
Where?
It wasn't, because you...
My memory's shit.
Yeah, was it not, what's it called? Come on, we know it.
Was it in Belgium?
What's the TV show called?
What TV show?
You know the TV show that everybody does, the blah blah blah.
Where were we in Belgium? It wasn't the AB Club, no?
No, it wasn't. I don't think we were in Belgium.
Were we in Holland?
No, what's the French TV show?
TV 5 Monde? No. French Arte? No, I don't know.
It wasn't
the Olympian Paris, I know that much.
No, it wasn't.
It was, because Jack Hill opened up for us in that show.
Really?
Yeah, Jack Hill did. Right. But I remember, I thought it was the AB Club in Belgium, but it was Belgium or Holland. I can't remember.
Was it?
It'll come to you. I'm sure it'll come. Well, it won't come to me, forget it. My memory's gone to shit.
What did you say?
Well, here's one for you, right? What? Here's it, because you...
Because I remember Hayes, that was great.
That was a great night.
That was great. And we had a good... We were sitting outside on the big square.
That's right, with Carl Odlum.
Yeah, and Dave Odlum.
Yeah, yeah.
That was not for... No, you tell me what you were going to say.
No, I just remember that night. And it's always nice when you're touring and you haven't been home for a while that you kind of meet a few friends.
And
we just went and had a beer. It was kind of a mellow night.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Here's one for you, right? We're on 4 albums together. Now here's the trivia one. Let's test your memory now. Can you name the 4 albums we're on together? And there's not many drummers I'm on albums with, okay? There's 2 Pugwash ones. I'll give you a hint.
Because okay? I was about to say Pugwash.
But there's the 2. One.
What? There's 2?
There's 2
you
Pugwash
said there's
albums.
4.
But we're on 4 albums together.
Ah, shit.
Because I only realised it when I was looking through some of the records you played on. I was like, I'm on that one. So I just thought it would be a good one to throw at you to see. We'll come back to it. We'll just keep that one on the back burner there, right? Okay? So let's go to Hayley. Right, you were touring with Gemma for what, about a year? You got me an audition with Gemma Hayes. Look, she's just the look on your face. You're still trying to think of the albums. You're just like that. I'm getting a stone cold look from Graham here. Do you want me to tell you?
No, don't.
No,
please don't
tell
me.
One hint.
Just give me one hint, I reckon
that would be interesting. Well, one album is a compilation. So you mentioned Pugwash, and one of those albums is Giddy, right? It's Giddy, which was the Pugwash compilation of the first three or four albums. And then there was another Pugwash record we played on. Do you remember the song you did? It was Anchor.